7. Deep state delusions. I was out of office when Donald Trump was inaugurated as our nation's 45th president. That was fine by me because I'm not sure I belonged to the Republican Party he created. Don't get me wrong. Of course, I wished him well as president and supported him on a number of traditionally conservative issues like cutting federal regulation, keeping taxes low, keeping our military strong, and putting constitutionalists on the federal bench. But while he made a lot of progress on these and plenty of other conservative priorities, he also spent a lot of time and mouth-flapping energy on stuff that really comes out of left field. From my perch, out of the fray, it was always a little puzzling to watch. I know times have changed and every president has to adapt. There's one thing, though, that never made any sense to me: Trump's obsession with the so-called deep state. Not only was this obsession misguided, it betrayed a lack of understanding of how government really works. I don't really blame Trump for that. The guy spent his entire career building apartments and office buildings, plus some truly wonderful golf courses. He had other stuff to worry about. And the deep state as a boogeyman is not an idea that Trump Republicans have vetted out of whole cloth. As long as I've been in politics, politicians have railed against this group or that group in Washington as the villain standing in the way of whatever they're trying to do. I too railed against the establishment as a young hothead. Then some hotheads railed against me. It's often good politics. Every good story needs a couple of bad guys, after all. It's true that within the federal agencies of the executive branch, there's an entrenched bureaucracy that likes to protect the status quo. Republicans in the past have portrayed them as stuffy and resistant to change, especially anxious to protect their patch from conservative efforts to shrink and streamline government. But this took a nastier turn in the Trump era. Bureaucrats went from cranky obstructionists to deep state villains engaged in a massive conspiracy against America as a whole, and Trump in particular. In his telling, they were nothing short of traitors. Unelected deep state operatives, Trump told a rally crowd in 2018, who defied the voters to push their own secret agenda, are truly a threat to democracy itself. But who are these operatives, exactly? He didn't make that clear. They're whoever he wanted to point a finger at that day, I guess. There's something very destructive, not to mention delusional, about the notion that there's some plot deep within the nation's capital, in the FBI, in the federal courts, in the intelligence community, to undermine democratically elected officials and, as Trump often charged, undo his election in 2016. Let me be diplomatic here. That's horseshit. To show you why, let me explain what, near as I can tell, I think Trump means when he talks about the deep state and his other favorite term, the swamp. The swamp is Washington, not a new term either. And the deep state is made up of people who've been there for a long time in non-elected positions of power. Within this crowd of unelected Washington veterans, there are two main groups, bureaucrats and lobbyists. Bureaucrats have been in Washington since, well, the Washington administration. Yes, they can be annoying as hell, but many of them actually do important jobs. They keep the machinery going, getting out Social Security checks and tax refunds, putting together scientific studies, paying and caring for service members, tracking the weather. And we need them. Republicans would like to make some cuts here and there, yes. But even most on the right would admit that some sort of bureaucracy is needed to run a country of hundreds of millions of people. And when people in the bureaucracy have been there a long time and have institutional knowledge, they usually make things work better than worse. Lobbyists are a little harder to defend, I admit, but let me take a crack at that one too. I know what most people think when they hear the word lobbyist. I can see it now. Some fat guy in a $5,000 suit, puffing a cigar, $100 bills bulging out of his pockets, plotting to light the world on fire so he can offer hose consultation services at a premium. I guess there are a few people who vaguely fit that description. There are some lobbyists, yes, who have a bad agenda. But you can suss those guys out pretty quickly if you're smart and make sure to avoid them. What most people don't understand is that lobbyists are not, on the whole, a bad thing. In fact, though the word lobbying does not appear in the Constitution, the right to lobby does. The First Amendment guarantees Americans the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That means if you don't like something the government is doing, you can make your case about it. And if you don't have time to do so yourself, you can join with other like-minded people in a trade association with others in your industry, for instance, and hire someone to make your case to the government on your behalf. If you're doing that, wouldn't you want that person to have the right connections to make sure your views get heard? That's all lobbying is, at its best. And when it's done right, it actually makes the government more accountable. Lobbyists also provide an essential service to lawmakers. Since lobbyists tend to focus on one particular issue, over time they become subject matter experts with invaluable expertise. In fact, our democracy can't work without these creatures of the swamp. Every capital city has them, not just Washington, D.C., but Sacramento and Denver and Columbus. They go where laws are made, and lawmakers need them. Sometimes they save us from ourselves. I was new to the Ohio State Legislature when I was approached about supporting a seemingly simple bill to get rid of the front license plates required on all cars in the state. At the time, many other states didn't require license plates to be on the front, just on the back. Some still don't. Why did Ohio have to have both? Like a small government conservative, I figured that cutting by half the number of license plates on cars would save the state money. We need to buy half as much metal and make half as many plates. I decided to co-sponsor the bill. It seemed simple enough. Not a big deal, right? Wrong. Very quickly, I became an unpopular person in Columbus. First, the folks from the Ohio School Bus Drivers Association showed up in my office. "You can't support this bill," they said. "Well, why not?" "Well, you know those flashing red lights that school buses switch on when they stop? When a car runs past one of our buses with its lights flashing, we have a better chance of getting their license plate number, and then we can notify the police." Well, I hadn't thought about that. Nobody wants to make it easier to put little kids in danger getting off the bus. Then I heard from every law enforcement group in Ohio, the State Sheriff's Association, the Highway Patrol, and the state chapter of the Fraternal Order of Police. "No, Boehner," they said. "We got to catch criminals. If you got two plates on a car, then we have twice as good a shot at catching them. You want to fight crime, right?" Oh, yeah, I did. I hadn't thought about that either. Then the good folks from the 3M company showed up at my office. Turned out the 3M made the reflective material that goes on all the license plates. "If this becomes law," they said, "we're going to lose half our business in the state," which meant people would lose their jobs in Ohio, including people in my district. For good measure, they repeated all the things I'd already heard from the school bus drivers and the state police and sheriffs and all the rest of them. Meanwhile, I wasn't just hearing from groups, but individuals too. I got letters and phone calls into my office all day. God almighty, all I'd done was co-sponsor some simple bill. What was going on? I got one of those twitches again. Something just wasn't right. So I decided a little investigation was in order. As it turned out, the people behind this seemingly harmless piece of legislation were members of the Ohio Car Wash Associations. When Ohioans took their cars through an automatic car wash, the scrubbing mechanism would occasionally bend or beat up the front license plate. Customers would get pissed and yell at the owners. The owners preferred that that didn't happen, of course. So instead of the expense of fixing their machines or paying for the damage to the cars, they decided to change the law and ruin my life. I remembered that story over the years because it makes a couple of points. The first is that nothing in government is simple or easy. When you try to change one thing for one group of people, it can upset a whole bunch of other groups you never even thought about. The second is that lobbyists have an expertise on various matters that a legislator cannot hope to have. The percentage of your elected officials who read each and every law they're voting on might surprise you. Other than a couple of nerds with a lot of time on their hands, it's zero. People act like this is some massive outrage, but it really isn't. We're a big, complicated country, and changing federal laws is a big, complicated deal. You'd have to be a skilled lawyer to understand some of the language of these bills. Amending Section 283D of the Whatever Act, which amends the IRS Code 433.6, which deletes paragraph 3 of something else, and even then, you'd have to examine a whole bunch of different codes and existing laws to check for all the references for any of it to make sense. Members of Congress don't have that time or expertise to do that. Some people on their staff do, but they're all overwhelmed as it is. Lobbyists make a living knowing what all these laws say. In that sense, lobbyists aren't just influencers, they're educators. When you're dealing with complicated bills on the Hill, you're going to hear from lobbyists on one side and lobbyists on the other, like the car wash owners versus the school bus drivers. Sometimes you'll hear from lobbyists who aren't particularly on one side or the other, but understand the issues and can help explain the pros and the cons. By the end of the day, if you listen to the lobbyist, you're going to know exactly what the language you're voting on actually does and how it affects real people. Who's going to win and who's going to lose? Who's going to benefit and who's not going to benefit? You cannot have a city council, a state legislature, or Congress without people who lobby. Most of the lobbyists I've dealt with were my constituents. I talked to farmers in my district about a corn bill or about soil and water protections. The local doctors would talk to me about healthcare issues. What may be good for this part of the state or that part of the country may not work elsewhere. If you didn't have these ongoing conversations with lobbyists from your district, you really wouldn't have a clue. None of which is to say that lobbying, which has become an industry in itself, can't be regulated or reformed in various ways. Lobbyists aren't all superheroes. They're capitalists like the rest of us, and sometimes their agenda to make a buck isn't in our best interest. But government is run by pitting competing interests against each other, and hopefully coming to a compromise. That is far easier said than done. One of the most controversial things I did as Speaker was to eliminate earmarks. Earmarks were a long-standing tradition in Congress, as cherished by members as free lunches or Christmas. What this tradition allowed was for members to carve out sweetheart deals for their districts, a post office, a federal building, a bridge, whatever, as part of a large federal spending bill. If it worked, it meant Congressman X would send out a press release claiming credit for bringing taxpayer dollars back to their communities. It was, as you would expect, very popular. The problem was that a lot of these projects either took advantage of taxpayers or just plain didn't make a lot of sense. Among the more notorious examples was Senator Robert Byrd's effort to basically dismantle the federal government of Washington and bring it back, piece by piece, to his home state of West Virginia. Another was my old friend Don Young, the guy who pulled the knife on me, who infamously supported money for a project that became known as the Bridge to Nowhere, which was pretty much what it sounds like. Okay, it didn't literally go nowhere, but it was an attempt to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to build a massive bridge between mainland Alaska and an island with a few dozen people on it that already had its own airport and a perfectly good ferry service. There was an entire industry in Washington, D.C. built on these earmarks. Former members of Congress and other groups would shake down everyone from universities to hospitals, museums, states, cities, counties, and try to convince them to hire them to lean on current lawmakers to get earmarks put into various bills. The firms had armies of lobbyists whose only job was to get earmarks inserted into legislation benefiting their clients. And usually, whatever amount they got of taxpayer dollars, they would get some percentage from the client in payment. When we got rid of earmarks, we destroyed that little cottage industry. Conservatives generally cheered this move, at least at the time, but it did not make me a hero to everyone. I remember running into a former member of Congress not long after the earmark reform passed. As it happened, he had just recently retired and gone to work as an earmark pusher. Before he even had time to get his business going, we had turned off the tap. When he saw me, he cussed me up one side and down the other. You'd have thought I'd have made a pass at his wife. Since then, and still to this day, there are covert and overt efforts to bring earmarks back into Congress, often pushed by very powerful industries. Some industries demonstrate how a particular lobby can be allowed to grow so powerful that it holds everyone hostage for no real good reason. Take ethanol, for example, gas made from ground-up corn. It's supposed to be more environmentally friendly or something. Baloney! Ethanol doesn't work, and it's expensive to produce. But most of the production goes on in major corn-producing states, the largest of which is Iowa. So a government mandate to use a certain amount of ethanol in fuels means, in practice, a major giveaway to Iowa corn producers. See where I'm going with this? Every politician thinks he can be president. Everyone starts their presidential campaigns in Iowa. And nobody wants to show up in Ames and piss off the farmers by telling them ethanol stinks. So ethanol subsidies live on. Another industry that's done a good job of keeping everybody's balls in a vise, sugar. The sugar people have had a very effective lobby for well over 140 years. For instance, sugar beets need a lot of water. So where do we grow them? We grow them where we've built reclamation projects and dams in the driest places in America. They drain all this water up because, as I said, beets take a lot of water. And why do they grow sugar beets in these dry places? As usual, because there's lots of money involved. The sugar lobbyists spend their entire waking day making sure there's a minimum price on sugar and limit how much sugar comes into the United States from overseas. It's protectionist, and frankly a bit socialist, if you ask me. I think Bernie Sanders would approve. The thing about Bernie, by the way, was that he's the most honest person to ever run for president, ever. We came to Congress together, and I can tell you, he genuinely believes all that crazy shit he says. So he may be nuts, but at least he's not cynical. And a non-cynical politician is rare, no matter how you slice it. Anyway, sugar prices in the United States are, by estimates, twice as high as everywhere else. In fact, the sugar industry receives about $4 billion, that's billion with a B, a year from American taxpayers to support some 4,500 sugar farms, protect their industry, and keep other players out. Not so sweet when you look into it, is it? More like a disgrace. Sugar was never really my fight, but I always thought it was a little silly that the sugar industry has all this power in Washington. But I like to spend my time on issues I might actually be able to change, and I knew the chances of winning a fight with Big Sugar was basically zero. At one point in the mid-1990s, I got fed up and decided to yank their chains anyway. I was on the Agriculture Committee, and we were getting ready to put together the 1996 Farm Bill. I walked into my office while this was going on and found the sugar lobbyists hanging around, trying to stay close to the action. I felt like being a smartass, so I made some wisecrack about the sugar industry raping taxpayers. Without another word, I walked into my private office and shut the door. I had no real plan to go after the sugar people. I was just screwing with the guy. My phone did not stop ringing for the next 5 weeks. The guy must have walked straight out of my office to the nearest phone booth, or maybe he had a cell phone even then, now these guys were loaded, and called his office and announced, "Boehner, Ohio 8th, code red." I had no idea how many people in my district were connected to the sugar industry. People were calling all day telling me they made pumps or plugs or boxes or some other such part used in sugar production, and I was threatening their job. Mayors called to tell me about employers their towns depended on who would be hurt by a sugar downturn. It was the most organized effort I'd ever seen. And that's why you don't fuck with sugar. People underestimate the power of the status quo. Changing the status quo is typically a monumental exercise because people get invested in the status quo. I don't care whether it's a line item in a tax bill or a particular regulation, there is someone somewhere who has a vested interest in what the law is or what the regulation is, and they typically don't want to see it changed. I'm not saying it can't be done, or you shouldn't try for real change if you're doing it for the right reasons. I'm saying it's stupid to go in thinking you'll be able to change everything, or anything, in Washington by waving some magic wand. I got a tough lesson in that working on the same farm bill in 1996. I was in my third term then, and for some reason, I was picked to be the guy from the House Agriculture Committee that was sent across the Capitol to talk through this bill with some key senators to negotiate a few points of disagreement. They probably picked me because nobody else wanted the job. But at the time, I was feeling pretty proud of myself, a third-termer already in the Republican leadership, walking over there to tell those senators how things were going to go with a big bill and give them the word from the House. where the real power was. Well, as soon as I walked into that conference room, I thought to myself, I'm not shit. There at the head of the table was the legendary Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. He had been chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee back in the 1980s and still held a lot of sway. Next to him was my old buddy, Senator Hal Heflin from Alabama. I believe he was allowed to smoke in this meeting, unlike the Clinton White House. These two, Helms the Republican and Heflin the Democrat, were the go-to guys on tobacco and peanut farming, and nothing was going to go into the farm bill without their nod. Helms was every inch the man in charge. He leaned back casually in his big chair and looked at me as I took my seat across the table. John, he said, nice to see you. Welcome to the United States Senate. I was on his turf, and he was making sure I knew it. I thought we were going to get down to business then, but he wasn't done. I think the best way for us to resolve these issues, Helms continued, is for you to talk with Senator Heflin. Whatever you and Senator Heflin can work out will be fine with me. And with that, Helms got up, and followed by his staff, walked right out of the room. Well, shit. That was a power move I hadn't been expecting. And there was Heflin, just grinning at me. He was in charge now. Over the next few hours, I did my best to push for the House version of the Farm Bill with the help of the team of House Ag staffers I brought over. We had binders and notes and all kinds of facts and figures to make our case. Through it all, Heflin just sat there like a sphinx. He was a tall, broad guy, filling the whole chair and dominating his side of the table. A big, immovable object, never giving any hint to what he was thinking while we went on and on. The final verdict of all of our suggestions was always the same. I don't think so. That was it. No negotiation, no back and forth. We kept trying and trying, but all we got was, I don't think so. We were there all day and half the night and went back the next day. And all we ended up doing was going through a lot more cigarettes and a lot more I don't think so's. I didn't get rolled that bad in a negotiation until I went up against Obama. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but when you're trying to change the status quo, chances are you're going to lose. If you want to change something that's been the same for a long time, you better have some forces working along with you to push the momentum in your direction. That's what I didn't understand. I was operating on my own, trying to take charge of writing this part of the farm bill. Helms and Heflin, on the other hand, had states full of peanut, tobacco, and other farmers with vested interests that their senators were damn sure going to protect. The major force was with them, so they got what they wanted. When you go out and try to make big changes on your own, like I did, you aren't going to win. To put it in a way that would probably make Heflin chuckle, it's kind of like playing with yourself. It might feel good, but it doesn't really get much done, does it? Still, sometimes you win, even up against especially formidable forces like the school lunch ladies. You think I'm kidding? When I was chairman of the Education and Workforce Committee, I learned that these gals were no joke. Early on, I was trying to put a bill together that made some modest changes to the federal school lunch program. Honestly, I can't remember what they were at this point, but they really aren't all that important to the story, as you'll see. Naturally, for a bill like this, we worked with the experts, the representatives of the School Cafeteria Workers Association. Yes, lunch ladies have lobbyists too, and they were some of the toughest in town. They weren't too happy about our bill to begin with. The cafeteria was their domain, and they did not like the idea of some guy in D.C., especially a new guy running the committee, trying to horn in. Every congressional district in America has schools, and every school has lunch ladies. They were everywhere. And when a call went out from their organization, they showed up. I had four or five of them from my district come to my office one day. When I went home and held events, they were there. You could always tell the lunch ladies, God bless them, they look the same everywhere, don't they? They showed up in packs, glaring and scowling at me like I'd just been caught stealing an extra brownie. In the end, we made a deal with them, and everything turned out okay, but it demonstrated again that you tread into changes like this at your peril. You have to know all the interests involved and what they need to work with you. Railing against them, calling them the establishment, or deep state, or whatever the preferred term of the day is, doesn't get you anywhere. That said, sometimes in order to get things done, you do have to shake things up. You might even have to threaten entrenched interest, but there's a strategic way to do that. That's what happened when we decided to mess with Head Start. Another popular program that most Americans don't know much about, other than it sounds good. That could be because most Americans don't pay attention to things that help low-income communities, but that's another problem. Head Start is a federal program that provides early childhood education and services to low-income parents and kids. In some places, it works great and does a wonderful job for people who need help the most. In other places, it's an easy employment program where teachers are hired as glorified babysitters and don't actually do anything to help kids. The program is run by the Department of Health and Human Services, and everyone knows who the good and bad Head Start operators are around the country. But they don't want to push too hard on the bad players, because that can make the whole program look bad. I wanted to do something about that, so I started off the process by setting out some simple goals. I wanted to make changes to Head Start to make educational standards stronger and everyone involved more accountable. My point was simple. The program exists, and there are kids involved, so shouldn't we expect that the kids are actually going to learn something? You would have thought that I was the devil himself showing up at these meetings. At first, the Head Start people absolutely kicked our asses, rhetorically. You could probably write the media story yourself. Evil Republicans trying to hurt poor kids. Valiant Head Start leaders trying to protect them. Well, I took that one more personally than usual. I've worked my whole life to help poor kids get better access to education through their schooling. You don't tell me I'm trying to make life tougher for them. Back off. I wasn't going to let the Head Start lobbyists walk all over me. I knew there were problems in their programs, even if they would not admit it. I didn't want to give them billions I was afraid would be wasted when it could actually go to helping kids. So I played rough. Our committee staff dug up a whole bunch of stories from around the country about just what some bad Head Start apples were doing with taxpayer dollars. Some of these guys were driving expensive cars with money that could have bought new teaching materials for classrooms. This changed the whole dynamic of the fight. We got them to the table, and we were able to work things out. So yes, playing hardball, or creative disruption, or whatever you want to call it, can and does work sometimes. Knee-jerk defenders of President Trump would often say that's what he was up to whenever there was some new pronouncement or action that didn't make sense. Well, they may have been right in some cases. I don't know. I'm not in the middle of it anymore. But having to constantly point to the deep state as the boogeyman responsible for all these problems just seems weird. We still don't know exactly who he means, but the likely suspects, bureaucrats and lobbyists, can actually be responsible for making government work better and stay more accountable to the people. That's when they do their jobs responsibly, which not all of them do. When the bureaucrats sandbag regulatory change or lobbyists try to flex too much muscle, it's a problem, and that's when you have to get tough. I get that, but even in those cases, it's a far cry from the massive government conspiracy that Trump liked to say was bent on unseating him. It almost seems like an attempt to deflect responsibility, but as every leader knows, the buck stops with him. All of this, it's worth remembering, can be seen through the various lenses of the media. What we see and hear in print, on the TV, on the radio, on the internet, has the power to shape our understanding of what's going on around us. That's just basic fact. President Trump was hardly the first president to struggle with a media he was convinced was out to get him. God knows I felt that way plenty of days. But the truth about how the American media works is more complicated. Far more complicated, certainly, than many conservatives think.